Hello, and thank you for joining the American Revolution. This week, episode 309, The North Government Falls. So this week we're looking at the British reaction to hearing the news of the surrender of Yorktown. The first word of the loss of the army under General Cornwallis came from a ship that heard about the news in France. On November 25, 1781, a packet ship sailing from Calais to Falmouth arrived with word that officials were celebrating in Paris over a great victory in Virginia. The messenger carried the news to Lord Germain, the American secretary. Although it was a Sunday, he sent word to the king and met with several other top officials. He and those officials went over to carry the news to Prime Minister Lord North, who exclaimed, oh God, it's all over. Now that day, word of the loss was still really a rumor, but that night, however, a Navy ship, the Rattlesnake, arrived carrying Admiral Thomas Graves' report of the surrender. For most of the government officials, they seemed to share Lord North's reaction, if not his emotional outburst. The loss of the army under Cornwallis probably meant that it was time to end the war in North America. But one man who did not share that opinion was George III. The king had long been the leading advocate for continuing the war and was largely responsible for maintaining a government that had supported his position. 2 days after word about Yorktown arrived, the king was due to give a speech before the opening of the new session in Parliament. Now, the speech had been written well before the news arrived, but it called for continued efforts to defend and preserve the empire. The king, however, specifically did address the news of Yorktown when he said, quote, "The events of war have been unfortunate to my army in Virginia, having ended in the loss of my forces in that province. But I retain the perfect conviction of the justice of my cause." Despite the setback, the king wished to continue the war in America. The king believed that North America was vital to the British Empire. Giving up there would only mean that colonies around the world would also push for independence. For the king, the fight for the colonies in North America was a fight for the continuation of the British Empire itself. The king's speech helped rally the Tories, but the opposition to the war had been growing long before the news of Yorktown, and this loss, of course, only strengthened the position of the opposition. George III asked Lord Germain to develop a new plan for the war. The American secretary's response was a proposal that Britain should retain its occupation of New York, Charleston, and Savannah. The two southern cities were particularly important as support bases for the war in the West Indies. He also recommended the recapture of Newport, Rhode Island, and the establishment of a base in Delaware to block trade to and from Philadelphia. The British Navy could continue efforts to blockade or attack rebel points, cutting off outside trade and assistance. Loyalists and Indian tribes would continue to receive military aid that would be used to harass the rebels. Britain would give up on trying to control entire colonies or even large portions of land. It would simply hold a few port cities, block most trade, and wait for the misery in the colonies to get the enemy to return to their senses and once again accept British rule. Germain's memo also noted that the rebel governments had essentially put themselves under French control. He believed that when the colonists realized their choice would be between serving France or serving Britain, they would inevitably want to return to British rule. The king reviewed this plan and gave it his support. In January, Germain began implementation of the new plans. He wrote to General Clinton in New York, telling him that he would not be getting significant numbers of reinforcements, but that he should continue to hold all current areas that were under British control. Those towns would support naval actions along the American coast. Germain also sent instructions to General Friedrich Haldimand in Quebec to continue providing support to Loyalists and Indians who wanted to continue the fight with the Americans along the northern border and the western frontier. Haldimand should also work on diplomatic efforts to draw Vermont back under British control. Now, despite putting the onus for North America on the Navy, the leadership was not prepared to provide more resources for that effort. Instead, focus was on other parts of the empire. Lord Sandwich, the First Lord of the Admiralty, sent instructions to Admiral Digby in New York to take the bulk of his fleet down to the West Indies to protect British interests there. Sandwich also deployed a fleet to India, carrying several more regiments of infantry and cavalry. As I discussed a few weeks ago, the French fleet under Admiral Suffren was actively attacking British interests in India, with the cooperation of Hyder Ali and the Mysore Kingdom. So Britain had to send resources there to protect its interests. At the ministry's request, a member of Parliament named David Hartley wrote a letter to Benjamin Franklin. Hartley and Franklin were friends from when Franklin was living in London before the war. Hartley broached the idea of trying to enter into separate negotiations with the American peace commissioners with the idea of calling a 10-year truce between Britain and America. Franklin's response shut down that option pretty quickly. For starters, the Americans were not permitted to seek a separate peace from France. Their treaty with France obligated them to remain in the war until France also secured a peace with Britain. So clearly, the British were just trying to divide up the two allies. Further, it didn't take a diplomatic genius to see how bad an idea a 10-year truce would be. That would only give time for Britain to defeat France and Spain, then rebuild its military, then renew its war in America. Franklin made clear that the U.S. was not quitting the war until the war with France ended, and that any conclusion of the war would recognize a permanent U.S. independence. What's clear from these communications, however, is that the North government realized that continued fighting in America at this time would only cause more problems for Britain. The focus was on the rest of the empire, with the hope of keeping the war in America on hold as long as possible. Meanwhile, the opposition in London was moving in a different direction. On December 12th, Sir James Lowther introduced a motion that determined that the British war in North America had, quote, proved ineffectual, and that the government should abandon its attempts to compel obedience in America. The motion ignored trigger words like independence, but the intent was clear. Britain should give up on America and the war there, and focus on France, Spain, and the Netherlands. Debate on the bill was heated, but in the end it failed 220 to 179, a decisive win for Lord North's government. One of the opposition leaders at the time was Charles James Fox. This leader in Parliament had begun his political career at age 19 when his father purchased a seat for him in the House of Commons in 1768. In his early years, Fox was pretty closely aligned with the king on many issues. He'd been one of the leaders to punish John Wilkes. His break with the king began, though, in 1770 when he opposed the Royal Marriages Act, which gave the king the authority to veto any marriage choice by the royal family. George III considered this a very important matter and took any opposition to it as a personal rejection to him. Several additional issues having nothing to do with America drove the two men apart over the next few years. By 1774, Fox was engaging more with the likes of Edmund Burke, another member of Parliament and a firm Whig who focused on restricting the king's authority in government. Burke became a staunch opponent of government policy in America, supporting instead a negotiated peace that respected American rights. Over the course of the war, both Fox and Burke recognized the need to accept American independence and led much of the opposition against the government's war in America. Burke had also started his political career as secretary to Charles Watson Wentworth, the second Marquess of Rockingham. Lord Rockingham had been close to George II, holding the title of Lord of the Bedchamber. After the death of George II, Rockingham became an early opponent of George III, and was removed from most of his government positions. By right of his title, however, he did hold a position in the House of Lords and became a leader there. Rockingham briefly served as Prime Minister in 1765 to 66, during which time he repealed the stamp tax in America. The king came to view this repeal as the cause of all the troubles, since it rewarded the rioters in America and gave them the idea that they could win more concessions through violence. In the king's view, Rockingham's accommodationist policies were a disaster. Throughout the war, Rockingham led the opposition to the North government in the House of Lords. He had long been a supporter of accommodation, and as early as 1779 believed that the war in America could not be won, and that refusing to recognize that fact only created further harm for Britain. The vote on the Lowther motion to end the war took place at 2 a.m. on the last day of the legislative session before Parliament left for Christmas. More than 100 members were already gone and did not vote on that matter. So both sides knew that they would have to revisit the issue when Parliament returned in January. So both the North government and the opposition spent Christmas break lobbying for their side. And when I say the North government lobbied, I mean officials in the government led by Lord North. The Prime Minister himself did not do much talking at all. After Parliament adjourned in December, North met with the King and told him that he believed it was time to recognize American independence. The King insisted that North remain publicly silent on the matter, only discussing it with Lord Stormont and Lord Hillsborough, two of the most pro-war leaders that were still in the government. I think the King hoped that these two men could bring North back to supporting the war. In the meantime, he did not want North talking about independence with anybody else. As a way of placating the opposition, the North ministry decided that there needed to be a human sacrifice. Lord Germain was the most outspoken supporter of continuing the war in America. The King, North, and others decided that he was going to have to go. Simply firing Germain or having him quit over the failures in America would not do, since that would only highlight the British failures in America. Instead, they came up with a way to push Germain out quietly. Now, as I said last week, General Clinton wanted to resign as commander of North America and return home. This became more compelling when General Cornwallis returned in January and began blaming Clinton for Yorktown to everyone he spoke with in London. The ministry decided to replace Clinton with General Guy Carleton. You may recall from earlier episodes that Carleton had managed to defend Quebec from rebel occupation at the beginning of the war. He'd been recalled after the loss at Saratoga, but he wasn't blamed for that. In fact, that loss under Burgoyne highlighted that the more conservative approach under Carleton was probably a better one. Carleton's main problem was Lord Germain. Carleton had served on the court-martial during the 7 Years' War that got Germain kicked out of the army. Germain never forgave him for that, and made it his mission to damage Carleton's military career whenever he could. So the decision to appoint Carleton as the new commander of all military forces in North America almost certainly would result in Germain's resignation as American secretary. The parties discussed this maneuver ahead of time to make sure it had minimal impact on the war effort. Germain set the price for his resignation as a new title and a seat in the House of Lords. After some debate, he received a title as a Viscount, which did in fact entitle him to sit in the House of Lords. Germain's replacement, Wellbore Ellis, was a longtime member of Parliament. He was pushing 70 and was selected primarily because he would be a non-entity who would sit quietly and not rock the boat. Ellis's only demand for taking the job was the promise of a pension. Several weeks after Parliament returned, a moderate member of Parliament, former General Henry Conway, put forward another resolution calling for an end to the offensive war in America. This resolution was a bit less aggressive. Ending the war only meant that things kind of went on hold. It did not mean recognizing American independence. This motion failed, but only by a single vote, 194 to 193. A week later, Conway tried again with a slightly revised resolution. North proposed an amendment to have the government, quote, treat with America on the footing of independence. By introducing the I word into the debate, North hoped to increase opposition to the measure. When his proposed amendment failed, North called for a delay on the vote for a few weeks. The members rejected all of North's efforts. The members knew that North was simply maneuvering to avoid a losing vote. Parliament remained in session, finally voting in favor of the motion at 2 a.m. on February 28th by a vote of 234 to 215. Later that day, the General Advertiser, a newspaper, hit the streets with the headline, Peace with America. This headline may have been a little premature. The Crown certainly was not ready to concede. The following day, the King received the leaders of the House of Commons to discuss the matter. Standing next to the King during this discussion was a general from America named Benedict Arnold. A few days later, the king gave a vague and evasive reply which seemed to indicate that he was not ready to concede the war. In response, back in Parliament, Conway proposed another resolution that said, quote, "The House of Commons would consider as enemies to His Majesty and this country anyone who, quote, advised or attempted to prosecute an offensive war in America." This resolution passed as well. A few days later, things got even worse when news arrived that the British outpost at Menorca had fallen to Spain. The opposition was confident enough by this point that they prepared to call for a vote of no confidence in the Prime Minister. Such a vote would remove Lord North from office and put a peace candidate in charge of the government. Now, North began a counteroffensive, reminding members of all the things the opposition might do once they were in charge. And this went well beyond ending the war. There were a whole bunch of policies that the opposition supported that a lot of members of Parliament were objecting to. North managed to defeat the motion by 10 votes, but in doing so, North knew that his days in office were numbered. The opposition had coalesced around Lord Rockingham as the new leader. Burke insisted that if he did take office, Rockingham could not let the king veto American independence. This was the critical change that needed to happen. Burke was also interested in purging the civil list, that is, terminating jobs for a great many government workers, something that the king used to reward his friends and manipulate votes in Parliament. When the king heard all of this, he drafted a speech abdicating the crown, turning over his office to his son, the Prince of Wales. In the speech, George III announced that he would move back to Hanover and no longer reign over Britain. Lord North managed to talk the king out of giving this speech, and he did remain on the throne. But even drafting such a speech gives you some idea of where the king's head was at. The king absolutely hated Lord Rockingham and couldn't conceive of him becoming the new prime minister. Although the king normally meets with a would-be prime minister who is seeking to form a government, in this case, the king refused such a meeting. George could not stand to be in the same room with Rockingham. On March 20th, the House of Commons prepared to move for a vote of no confidence against Lord North. Before they could do so, North demanded the floor. Lord Surrey was scheduled to take the floor and call for the vote of no confidence, so when North demanded the floor, everyone expected that he was probably going to resign. The opposition objected to this because they wanted to embarrass the ministry by forcing a no-confidence vote rather than simply allow a resignation. So Parliament got into a heated argument over who was allowed to speak first for over an hour. During the arguing, North just blurted out that they were wasting their time since the entire government had already resigned. North then moved for an adjournment and went home. Lord Rockingham already had majority support lined up. The king still refused to meet with him, instead agreeing to meet with Lord Shelburne, his assistant. Rockingham had Shelburne provide the king with a list of new government officials, none of whom the king liked. Even so, the king really had no choice but to approve. Edmund Burke became the new paymaster of the forces. Lord Shelburne would be Secretary of State for Home and Colonial Affairs. Charles James Fox would be Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs. The position of American Secretary would be abolished, given that there would soon be no America to rule over. Most of the new ministers wanted an immediate recognition of American independence. Shelburne was one of the exceptions to this. He was still hoping the government might negotiate some sort of reconciliation by making other concessions to the colonies. And because of this, the pro-independence Fox demanded a role on the team that would negotiate with the Americans, preventing Shelburne from just dragging out these negotiations. Burke, even before the new government was created, had written to Benjamin Franklin in France, informing the Americans that Parliament now supported American independence and that it was just a matter of working out the details. On April 1st, the Rockingham government purged the government of North Loyalists, replacing government officials with their own people. That same month, they sent Richard Oswald to France to open up peace negotiations with the American commissioners. It would take months for the negotiations to begin, but the process of ending the war had begun. We'll get into those negotiations in an upcoming episode. In the meantime, next week, we're going to return to America as disputes with Native Americans result in the Gnadenhütten Massacre. Hey, thanks for joining the American Revolution Podcast After Show, part of the Airwave Media Network. Thanks to my Patreon supporters in the Alexander Hamilton Club, George Davis, Mike Hager, John Salentano, Michael Mulhern, and the Sons of the American Revolution. And you can check out the SARs podcast at fastfunhistory.com. Thanks to Robert Morris Circle supporters, Anthony McGinnis, Greg Pusak, and 10crucialdays.org. I'm grateful to everyone who supports this podcast on Patreon. You get access to ad-free episodes for as little as $2 a month. And for my $10 level supporters and higher, I will send you a new magnet each month with a different flag from the American Revolution. And of course, with each magnet, I also include a short history of the flag. It's an interesting way to learn more about the war. More importantly, your contribution helps the continuation of this podcast. I also appreciate gifts via PayPal or Venmo for people who just want to make a one-time gift rather than an ongoing contribution. Well, this week, we covered the decision in London to end the war in America. The decision to end the war seemed clear when Parliament voted out Lord North and voted in Lord Rockingham. Even so, the final peace would take another 2 years. For starters, the King was not really on board. He was acceding to the will of Parliament, but it was clear that he still wanted to fight and retain control over the American colonies. In Parliament, the costs of maintaining the war in America, and with those costs, the risk of losing even more colonies around the world, made many in Parliament ready to receive peace even years before all this happened. But it really was the stunning loss at Yorktown that pushed the majority into accepting the need for peace. Now, in some upcoming episodes, we'll discuss the lengthy negotiations and the final peace treaty. None of this process was particularly easy, in large part because of long communication times. It didn't take a short time to get all this done. The fall of the North government was not the end of Lord North's political career, though. The year after the fall of his government, North is going to enter into a new coalition with Charles James Fox. Given that these guys were political enemies in 1782, but working together by 1783, says something about the flexibility of politics in this system. North is going to become the Home Secretary in this new coalition at a time when the government was still finalizing the Treaty of Paris. Now, the King, of course, saw North's participation in this new coalition as a personal betrayal, and the King absolutely hated Fox and couldn't believe North wanted to have anything to do with him. But again, this is all going to happen next year, and we'll probably talk about it more in a future episode. Even after that short-lived coalition fell, North remained in Parliament. The only reason he left the House of Commons in 1790 was because his father died, and he inherited the title of Earl of Guildford. This bumped him up into the House of Lords. And when he did, North's son took his seat in the House of Commons. Another interesting aside, Lord North's estate, Roxton Abbey, was donated to Trinity College in 1932, and the college sold it to Dickinson University in 1964. Ever since then, that New Jersey university has used Lord North's former estate to house American students studying in Britain. If you want to read more about Lord North, my book recommendation this week is a biography simply called Lord North by W. Baring Pemberton. This is an older book, first published in 1938, and there's cheap used copies available on Amazon. I think this book should have passed into the public domain, but the copy that is on archive.org is still listed as borrow only. I did recommend another North biography in an earlier episode. That earlier one was pretty expensive, even for used copies. This biography seems like a pretty good one to me and is much more inexpensive to buy. Again, the book is Lord North by W. Baring Pemberton. My online recommendation is The Correspondence of King George III with Lord North, Volume 2. This is a compilation of letters that the King wrote to Lord North during the Revolutionary War. It's a great primary source into what the King was thinking and what he wanted North to do. The copy I've linked to on archive.org was published in 1867, which means it's clearly in the public domain. And as always, I've included direct links on my blog and website. My question this week comes from listener Rob Payne, who asks about dueling. He says, dueling is such an interesting topic. The way the courts handled it at the time was comical. Oh, you killed a guy because he insulted your wife? Eh, that's fine. Being from Savannah, I'm most familiar with the Guidette versus McIntosh showdown. What are your favorite duels of the American Revolution era? Well, Rob, dueling has also been a fascination of mine. You mentioned the Guidette-McIntosh duel, which may have been the most significant one during the Revolution, because it led to the first death of a signer of the Declaration. Of course, the Hamilton-Burr duel of 1804 is probably the most famous one in American history. Another one from the Revolution that I've read about with fascination was the duel between Pennsylvania General John Cadwallader and Continental General Thomas Conway in 1778. Cadwallader brought the challenge on behalf of General Washington, under the assertion that Conway had injured Washington's reputation when trying to get him removed as commander-in-chief during what we now call the Conway Cabal. That duel ended up being non-fatal, but Conway was very badly injured. The irony of the duel on Washington's behalf was that Washington himself greatly discouraged dueling, especially between officers during the war, since it was obviously going to hamper the war effort. Washington never in his life personally engaged in a duel. The practice of dueling came out of the Middle Ages in Europe. There were few laws governing the practice, but there were very certain norms that were usually followed. Combatants usually had to be from the same class. A person of a lower order could not challenge someone from a higher class to a duel. Typically, each party would choose seconds. If an aggrieved party did not go directly, then the challenger's second would go to the other party and demand an apology for the perceived insult. If there was an apology, that would usually end the matter. If not, the parties would set a time and place for a duel. The challenged party would usually be entitled to choose the place and the weapons used. Pistols were most commonly used during this period, having replaced swords. And given the way society worked at the time, it's easier to understand why dueling was an accepted custom. Leading men were most respected for their bravery. Taking someone to court was not seen as a way of resolving an issue of honor. Especially among the elites, there had to be some level of respect and cooperation between men, or they would not be able to govern effectively. The threat of dueling probably kept a lot of name-calling and backbiting from happening in the first place, and if two men really couldn't come to terms, the duel would end one of their lives, and at least that would be a way of restoring civility. Dueling pistols themselves were notoriously inaccurate. There was always a chance of death, but not necessarily a high one. Many duelists met on the field of honor to show they were willing to put their life on the line to protect their honor, but would also agree to resolve their dispute before firing. If they did fire and no one was hit, there would be another opportunity then to resolve the matter without bloodshed. Firing, however, would continue if both men were determined to do so. Just participating in a duel proved you put your honor ahead of your life, something that was seen as critical for gentlemen of that era. It also showed your ability to stand calmly in the face of fire, something that any good military officer would have to have the capacity to do. Murder laws did not seem to apply to these situations. The best argument that I've heard for why not is that an attack on your honor is considered fighting words, which you are obligated to defend, probably more so than defending just your life. The fact that both men faced each other armed and ready to fire also made the firing on each person's behalf a matter of self-defense. Dueling in America seemed to become even more commonplace in the early 1800s than it was during the Revolution. It was at that time, though, that states really began to pass and enforce anti-dueling laws in an attempt to stamp out the practice. Even so, it remained a powerful form of dispute resolution through the American Civil War. If you have a question you'd like me to answer, please reach out to me either via email or on Twitter, Facebook, Quora, or Reddit. Well, that's all for this week. I hope you will join me again next week for another American Revolution podcast.